This is the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of podcasts, special programs, and homemade radio features. Tonight, we explore the relationship between the eclipse and your retina.
Oh, the rays of light get concentrated or focused directly onto the retina. So essentially what you get is a burn on your retina, and that creates blind spots in the very central field of your vision.
We'll also hear about an app with Hartzell Roots that's catching on with eclipse trackers across the globe.
This is one of the times that the average person can actually see the motion of the celestial bodies.
During 51%, we'll hear from an ambassadrix and learn about a program helping pregnant women trying to beat opioid addictions. And Engines of Our Ingenuity explores what some consider to be the greatest meeting of scientific minds ever.
The act of observation caused existence. Einstein wouldn't have any of it.
The mic is hot on the Public Radio Hour here on 89.3 Huntsville. Here we go. This is 89.3 Huntsville, and you're listening to the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of podcasts and homemade radio features. Tonight, stories about the sun, moon, stars, and things in between. This month's featured programs are 51% and Engines of Our Ingenuity. That's coming up. If you haven't heard, on Monday, the Tennessee Valley will experience a cosmic alignment of our moon and the sun, creating a light so bright it will cause permanent eye damage if viewed with the naked eye. It will also cause retinal damage if you view with eclipse glasses not up to standard. The best info is on the NASA website. But basically, if you put your glasses on, you shouldn't see anything except the very brightest of lights, like the flash of a camera. The retina is delicate and critical to clear eyesight. Jenny Kennedy spoke with Dr. Alexander Talalite, who specializes in retinal diseases at the Retina Center of Alabama.
The retina is a delicate lining in the back wall of the eye that is made up of tens of millions of tiny photoreceptor cells called rods and cones. If I may use an imperfect analogy with a screen in a movie theater, so the retina is that kind of screen inside the eye onto which the images get projected. And the photoreceptor cells record those images and send them to the brain. So without the retina, there is no vision.
So how does the damage occur to the retina if you're looking at the eclipse?
Well, remember when you were a kid and you used a magnifying glass to concentrate sun rays onto a piece of paper to burn it?
Maybe you did that. But
well, if you can think of what can possibly happen to the retina when sunlight gets focused onto the retina by the eye is a very sophisticated optical device, and it has a strong magnifier built on into it, and the light, or the rays of light, get concentrated or focused directly onto the retina. So essentially what you get is a burn on your retina, and that creates blind spots in the very central field of your vision.
So would you go completely blind, or do you get like crescents burned onto your eyes? I'm getting all sorts of conflicting information about what actually happens to your retina.
No, you will not go completely blind because the spot where the light actually focuses is fairly small. We call it the macula. But you will cause damage to the macula, and that's the part of the eye that's responsible for fine detailed vision. That's how you are able to read small letters, recognize people's faces. So once there is a blind spot in the very center of your vision, you will have a hard time seeing smaller objects. But you will not go completely blind. But you might not be able to drive a car again or read another word again.
Oh, so definitely not something you want to even try. Let's not even experiment. They're saying it'll fry your retina, but there is burning occurring.
Correct. And, you really don't want to try this because damage that occurs will be irreparable. There's not a whole lot that we can do once that burn has taken place.
So what can we do to prevent the damage?
Well, in the first place, you need to wear special kind of certified solar sunglasses when you view the eclipse.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of those, and I know that NASA has had some, and they're available online, although you do kind of need to be careful. How do you know if you have the correct glasses? Is there any way to tell? I know there's a code on the side, but can you tell just by putting them on?
Well, in the first place, not every pair of sunglasses will work. As a matter of fact, regular sunglasses are grossly inadequate for looking at the sun. And the industry has certain standards, and all sunglasses are rated based on their optical density. That basically tells you how dark they are. And regular pair of sunglasses would have optical density between 2 and 3, which means they cut down the amount of incoming light by 100 to 1,000 times. Whereas solar sunglasses will have optical density of a minimum of 5, which reduces the incoming light by 100,000-fold, which is, you know, about 300 times darker than regular sunglasses.
Yeah, I put on a pair and I couldn't see anything at all.
And that's how it's supposed to be. If you put on a pair of solar glasses, you're not supposed to see anything except the brightest points of light, which is what the sun is. And you also have to be careful about where you buy those sunglasses because, for example, Amazon just issued a recall on some fake glasses that did not comport to the industry standards. The American Astronomical Society on their website has a list of approved manufacturers for solar sunglasses, and I recommend that people who are interested in getting the real stuff, they need to go onto that website and verify that what they have currently is something that's really approved. Other than that, on your own, there is no way for you to test because you don't have specialized testing equipment.
And what about you on Monday? Are you going to go out and watch it?
I'll be working on Monday. When the eclipse occurs, if it is not overcast, I may walk out for a couple of minutes to take a look. Yes.
Okay, so on days that we aren't having a near total eclipse, are there any, which is, you know, like most days, do you have any other advice for just keeping our retinas healthy in general?
Well, on bright days, when it is sunny outside, it's a good idea to wear sunglasses no matter what, because light damage does accumulate in the retinas, and eventually as we age, it can lead to macular degeneration. And beyond anything else, the most important thing that you can do for yourself is really to prevent trauma to your eyes. That's where we see most injuries and damage to people's vision occurring, especially in younger people.
You can find this interview on our website at wlrh.org. Later this hour, we'll have a conversation with Eclipse super enthusiast Dr. Gordon Telepin and Tony Boster with Orange Wave Apps of Morgan County about an app to help you track Monday's eclipse. Partial eclipse begins Monday at noon, maximum eclipse is at 1:30, and partial eclipse ends at 2:56. Up next, it's Women Witnessing War on 51%, and Engines of Our Ingenuity revisits the 1927 Conference on Quantum Mechanics, which could be the greatest meeting of minds in modern history. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville.
On this week's 51%, we hear from a former war correspondent.
Look, it's terrifying, and anyone who tells you otherwise is lying.
She's out with a book, and we learn how a clinic is helping bridge the gap between insurance companies and pregnant women fighting opioid addiction. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Linda Schuster is a former Wall Street Journal reporter who began her career in the 1980s. She was the Central America correspondent, reporting on the wars in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. In 1983, she became the Journal's Mexico bureau chief. Following the assassination of her first husband, a veteran correspondent, Schuster was transferred to Beirut. After a time in the Middle East, she became the South America correspondent. She left the Wall Street Journal in the late 1980s to follow her current husband to his diplomatic posting in Malawi and served as the Christian Science Monitor's South Africa bureau chief. And now she has a new book, Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. I asked her why she decided to write the book.
I think it was partly out of a desire to make sense of one's life, which I think is sort of a very natural inclination that a lot of people have. I think partly was also to show other women out there that they can and should follow their hearts and their minds. That's not to say they might not end up back exactly where they started, which is kind of what happened with me, but if they don't ever try, they'll never know. And so I think that was one of the impulses to write this book.
What made you become a war correspondent?
Well, I didn't. That was kind of inadvertent. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. So as I write in my book, I ran away from home at age 16 and landed in the middle of Israel's Yom Kippur War, which was completely inadvertent. And I guess it should have scared the daylights out of me, but instead it sort of whetted my appetite for adventure. So I knew that I wanted that sort of a life, but getting there was quite another matter. So I fell into journalism kind of by default when trying to figure out where to go to graduate school. But having decided on the career, I was determined to spend as little time as possible working domestically. And I got very lucky and was hired by the Wall Street Journal right out of college. And they back then, they would fly you to New York and have you interview with all of their editors. And they asked me, and which of our many bureaus would you like to work in around the country? And I said, oh, I never want to work domestically. I only want to work as a foreign correspondent. And they sort of nodded their heads very understandingly and promptly dispatched me to their Dallas bureau, which I guess to a New Yorker is foreign. But then I got very, very lucky because I was assigned within 1 year to cover Central America, which at that time was one of the hottest stories around.
Of course. And just put us in that time frame, please.
It was the early 1980s. This is President Reagan was in the White House, and there was something called the Reagan Doctrine, where we were going to be in Central America and try to promote democracy. At that time, the Sandinistas, who were basically communists, were ruling Nicaragua. There was a civil war going on in El Salvador. This was a time when we covertly started funding the Contras out of Honduras to try to overthrow the Sandinista government. So it was quite an interesting time, to say the least.
So what was it like to be a woman covering this?
You know, it's interesting because I write about this in my book. First of all, not only was I a woman, I was a very young and very green reporter. I mean, I was basically sent to Central America within a year of being hired by the journal. And I was sort of out there competing against veteran foreign correspondents, most of whom were men. The great Shirley Christian of the Miami Herald, who won a Pulitzer for her coverage in Central America, was working then. And there were a few others, but by and large, they were men. And I always had the feeling that, you know, the men were these kind of, and I don't know whether it was a function of them being men or the fact that they were veterans, but they were a lot more, I don't know, sort of hard-bitten, a bit more callous, I think. And I would listen to these stories of families being burned to death and mothers losing their children, and it was almost, it was very hard at times to deal with.
You know, we're all affected differently by stories, both as reporters and as those reading or listening to the stories. And I wonder how gender-specific that is. How do you put how war is affecting you aside, in a sense, and do your work?
Well, you have to do, you have a job to do, and so you have to. I mean, I write about in the book how sometimes I would just go back to my hotel room and cry. And I truly suspected that most of my male counterparts did not. And I did not see that as a sign of weakness. I saw that as a part of my humanity. And again, you know, it would have been interesting if I had stayed in the profession for 20 years, whether I would have gotten as sort of perhaps hard-bitten and as callous as some of my male counterparts. But it is hard. And the other thing that keeps you going is the thought that you have a job to do, and if you can get this story out, if you can get this one person's story out, maybe it'll make a difference. You know, the saying about journalism is that it's a first draft of history. And so if it's not written about, people aren't going to know. And so that was one of the things that would always keep me going, is the idea that I have this ability to write about it and to get it out there. And in that way, I am making a contribution.
You know, Linda, I feel similarly, and also about the crying, both getting the story out there and it's not weakness, it's humanity. That said, I'd like to know which stories, situations, countries, you name it, have impacted you the most. Or, as you said, with journalism being a first draft of history, which stories do you feel were most on that path?
You know, I experienced some really horrible wars, but I think the story that has stuck with me the most was covering the fall of apartheid in South Africa. I had never seen anything like this in my life. Racism writ large, institutionalized, with very little recourse. I think one of the first interviews I did, I covered South Africa at the end of the 80s, and one of the first interviews I did was with a judge, an Afrikaner judge, so this was part of the ruling white class, minority white class of South Africa, said to me, you know, when I look down from my bench at a black man, I don't see a human being, I see a monkey. And that has stuck with me over the past 20 years. It's just, I just had never heard anything like that in my life. And the fact that there was absolutely no institutional recourse. I grew up in the United States during the time of the Civil Rights Movement. And yes, we have a lot of problems still in this country, but we do have some, thank goodness, we do have institutional recourses. We have the law. We have the Constitution. There, the racism was written into law. The color of your skin determined everything. It determined literally where you could be born, where you could grow up, what school you could go to, what profession you could aspire to, whom you could marry, and literally where you could be buried when you died. And it had nothing to do with the contents of your mind or your heart. It had everything to do with basically just the happen chance of your skin color.
A predetermined life.
Right.
And when you hear what you heard, it's jaw-dropping.
It was.
I can only imagine. And I can only imagine what it would have been like to cover the fall of apartheid.
It was pretty remarkable. I actually ended up leaving just before, timing is everything, I ended up actually leaving just before Nelson Mandela was released from prison. But as I write in my book, because I had a lot of problems covering doing this job. As I wrote in my book, one day a political officer at the U.S. Embassy called me to his office and said, let's take a walk around the block, on the assumption that his office was bugged. And he said to me, I am afraid that you are going to have a car accident. And I said, this is what you called me to your office to tell me? He said, no, you don't understand. What you're writing about is very close to the bone for the South African state. And I am afraid that one of these days you will be in a car accident, a fatal car accident, and you are not going to know the difference. No one's going to know the difference because people drive like maniacs in South Africa, and they won't realize, no one will realize that this was an assassination attempt, but just that you had a car accident. Now, I'm sure you can imagine that that's a little bit of a chilling thing to hear, especially because Johannesburg is like Los Angeles. You have to have a car to drive around. And so, of course, after that, I was completely paranoid. But it was very clear that I was being followed and I was being harassed. And so I came to the end of my contract to work there and ultimately ended up going to Liberia to marry my second husband, who was a diplomat, and thought I would have a very calm life now as the wife of a diplomat. And 5 days before we were to be married, the Liberian Civil War broke out, which was just one of the most horrendous things I ever witnessed. But the reason I tell you this story is because, fast forward a few more years, my husband was named ambassador to Mozambique, which is a country in southern Africa, just above South Africa. And we were very privileged to be invited down to South Africa to celebrate in the inauguration of Nelson Mandela's presidency. And this was one of the most moving moments I ever saw. Nelson Mandela pulled up to the Union Buildings, which is kind of like their parliament. It's their parliament. It's like their congressional area, like the Hill in Washington. And he pulled up to be sworn in a limousine, and sort of five military officers, kind of their chiefs of staff, met him as he walked, got out of the car, formed a little protective cordon around him and walked him to the reviewing stand. These were the same men, essentially, who had hunted Mandela down, who had imprisoned him for 27 years, who had not allowed him out when his son was killed to go to the funeral, to any of life's events, and yet these people surrounded him and saluted him on the day that he was inaugurated as president, and it was one of the most moving things I was ever privileged to witness.
Huh. Now, when you went to Liberia, I'm backtracking, to marry your second husband,
mm-hmm.
had journalism come to an end for you?
No, I still was freelancing. I was actually going to be writing a book about Liberia, and then the war exploded.
So here you are on this trajectory. You're still connected with writing and journalism because you're freelancing, but you've entered a new kind of life, and it's somewhat paradoxical to what you were doing.
Well, it was not just paradoxical. It was antithetical to what I had been doing. When someone becomes an ambassador, he or she is required to take a 2-week course at the State Department. Now, 20 or so years ago, when my husband was first named ambassador, everyone in that course was male, and all the spouses were female. And this is something I call Ambassatrix School. That is not the official name. That is simply my name for it. And it was just downright bizarre. It was, maybe the course has changed since I experienced it, but it felt like a throwback to the 1950s. You know, as I wrote in my book, all the ambassadorial appointees were men, and it was assumed that none of the wives had careers. Or if they did, they sort of gladly jettisoned them at the drop of a hat for the chance to help their husbands represent the U.S. abroad. So during the course, while our husbands got juicy classified briefings on their respective countries, we women got such scintillating lectures as, "Your China pattern's in you." And it was like someone forgot to tell the State Department that Mamie Eisenhower was dead.
That is too funny. And you kind of just want to throw up.
Yeah, well, yes. But on the other hand, you know, as far as being the wife of a U.S. ambassador, so when my husband was posted to Mozambique, I would commute down to South Africa because I wanted to write a book about South African family of 13 children, all of whom were very, very involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. So I actually had work. But, you know, as far as being the wife of a U.S. ambassador abroad, it was kind of a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, because of my husband's position, I got to meet people and experience things that I never would have been able to do as a journalist. But on the other hand, at that level, you live in this rarefied bubble. It's, you know, it's all cocktail parties and diplomatic receptions and state dinners and rubbing shoulders with all the oligarchs. And when my husband was ambassador to Peru, we lived in a 22,000 square foot mansion with cooks and butlers and upstairs maids. You know, and a place like that has its own microclimate, for gosh sakes. So you rarely get to meet and interact with ordinary citizens, you know, something that I really enjoyed as a journalist and which gives you a broader understanding of the country you're living in.
So given what your life has brought you, where you've gone, what you've done, where are you most comfortable? I mean, is a staid life more agreeable with you, or when you hear or read or see something about a war in country X, you kind of wish you were there on the front lines?
Both, always. It's a split brain. I think that having had a child changed absolutely everything. I wrote about in my book how when I was covering Central America, I truly never wanted to have children, and I can remember sitting at the bar in my hotel in San Salvador, having a discussion with a television reporter who was sitting next to me, and she was whispering to me saying, "I don't want to be here. I have a 6-year-old son at home. I don't want to die. I don't even want to think about dying." And I said, "I'm sorry to hear that." And she said, "Do you have any children?" And I said, "No, and I never intend to have any." And she said, "You have no idea what it's like." And it's true. I had no idea what it was like. I couldn't fathom doing what I did, having a child at home. On the other hand, every time I see some amazing story occurring somewhere in the world, there is a part of me that's kind of leaning forward in my seat, wanting to grab my overnight bag and go off and cover it.
What do you think is missing in today's journalism? When it comes to abroad, should our focus be elsewhere?
I think that the refugee problem is an enormous problem, and obviously one that ties into what is seen as the problem at our southern border. I don't think that people have enough context. First of all, I think there's a lot of refugee fatigue just because there are so many wars occurring all over the world now, and there are so many people both internally and externally displaced. I think just trying to humanize these people is so important. I mean, these poor people you see being pulled out of boats in the Mediterranean, these people didn't do this for a lark. Imagine the misery and the despair that would drive someone to do that. And I don't think that that is emphasized enough.
You know, Linda, I was thinking about before you're covering conflicts and wars and was wondering, you know, you don't enter this thinking, or do you enter covering such events thinking that you are immune from death? I mean, obviously what happened with your first husband is proof that one's not. How did you on a daily basis, I mean, did you ever even think of dying on the job?
Well, I didn't actually until my first husband was killed by a landmine on the Honduran-Nicaraguan border. Because I think you basically, look, it's terrifying, and anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. But I think that you go about it in the same way that one goes about one's normal life, and that is that you assume a certain amount of risk, you know, anytime you get in your car and drive. You assume the chances are fairly slim that anything bad is going to happen to you until it does. And then it became increasingly more difficult for me to justify putting myself out there as time went on. I also have to tell you that it takes a tremendous toll on people's lives. It happens with women, but I think it happens more with men. They become action junkies. They become addicted to the adrenaline rush of being at war, and they can't give it up. That's what they have to be doing. And I saw so much alcoholism and so many busted marriages, and that is not what I wanted for the rest of my life.
What advice do you have for aspiring female journalists who want to be on the front lines?
Well, my advice is to do it young, because, as I say, if you have any desire to have a family, I think it's really difficult to do that. I'd say learn languages, because that will always give you a leg up on your competitors. And I'd say don't ever let anyone tell you that you can't do it, because you can as well as anybody else.
That was Linda Schuster, whose new book is Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix.
This is an Alabama Legacy Moment.
From 1820 to 1826, Cahaba was the first capital of the state of Alabama. The capital city was located at the convergence of the Alabama and Cahaba Rivers because Governor William Wyatt Bibb had arranged for a free gift of land for that purpose from the federal government. An ancient Indian earthwork was found on the site, so the governor reused it as a dramatic centerpiece for the town plan. The sale of lots in Cahaba built the state treasury for the new state and paid for the first state house. Soon, the frontier capital had two newspapers, numerous businesses, a theater, and nearly 1,000 inhabitants. Despite the loss of the capital to Tuscaloosa in 1826, Cahaba, as a county seat, grew into one of the wealthiest communities in the nation and did not become a ghost town until well after the Civil War. Cahaba was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1973. Today, it is known as the Old Cahaba Archaeological Park.
Sponsored by the Alabama Bicentennial Commission, the ABA, and this station.
This is 89.3 FM HD1 Huntsville, and you're in the Public Radio Hour. Up next, we'll remember the ruckus raised at the 1927 Conference on Quantum Mechanics with Engines of Our Ingenuity. And the final segment of 51% looks at the challenge of receiving treatment for opioid addiction if you're pregnant. Then, we'll meet an app designer from Hartsel and an Eclipse super enthusiast. City Arts and Lectures is coming up at the top of the hour. Stay tuned.
This is the Engines of Our Ingenuity, made possible in part by NG, sustainable energy and tools for efficiency and carbon reduction.
Today, a clash of titans.
The University of Houston's College of Engineering presents this series about the machines that make our civilization run and the people whose ingenuity created them. It was one of the most famous scientific meetings in all of history. 17 of the 29 attendees had either received or would receive Nobel Prizes. But what made the conference so memorable was a disagreement. A disagreement between two of the titans of physics, Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein. The year was 1927, and physicists were puzzled. At question was the very nature of the extremely small. Were electrons, light, and similar entities waves or particles? In some experiments, the tiny entities behaved like waves, while in others, they behaved like particles. That's just not possible in our macroscopic world. Sound waves don't behave like pebbles, and thankfully so, or your ears would be stinging right now. The 1927 conference on quantum mechanics was held to discuss how the many seemingly contradictory observations could be reconciled. Schrödinger and de Broglie showed up with their ideas. But the 800-pound gorilla was Bohr. In what later came to be called the Copenhagen interpretation, Bohr proposed that wave equations described where entities like electrons could be, but the entities didn't actually exist as particles until someone went looking for them. The act of observation caused existence. In Bohr's own words, the entities in question had no independent reality in the ordinary physical sense. Einstein wouldn't have any of it. An electron was an electron, and just because someone wasn't looking at it, it was still there, wherever there happened to be. Late in the conference, Einstein rose to challenge Bohr's views. But that was only the beginning. Until Einstein's death some 3 decades later, Bohr and Einstein entered into spirited debates, in print and face-to-face. The debates were gentlemanly. Bohr and Einstein were friends and had great respect for one another. But they were also stubborn. It is wrong to think the task of physics is to find out how nature is, said Bohr. Einstein disagreed. What we call science, he said, has the sole purpose of determining what is. Through all its strangeness, Bohr's Copenhagen interpretation remains one of the most widely accepted worldviews of quantum mechanics. Other common interpretations are seemingly even more bizarre. But they all point to one simple fact. Our universe, as any physicist will tell you, is a mysterious place. It teases us with unimaginable facts, then leaves us to make sense of them. Perhaps someday we will. But until then, we'll just have to savor the great mysteries that surround us. I'm Andy Boyd at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
A transcript of this Engines of Our Ingenuity episode, number 2627, is online at uh.edu/engines. Additional episodes are available by podcast.
This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. Here's the final segment of 51%.
Insurance companies set rules that sometimes make patients go for days without medicine to treat opioid addiction. These rules are especially tough on pregnant women. One prenatal clinic at Indiana University Health University Hospital in Indianapolis helps patients clear those insurance hurdles. Side Effects Public Media's Emily Foreman reports.
Like this patient, I made 1, 2, 3 calls.
Nurse Biz Grimes keeps what she refers to as a log of Medicaid messes and nightmares.
And that was a total of 70 minutes.
According to her notes, she easily spends over 20 hours a week calling pharmacy directors and insurance plan supervisors.
It's like, okay, this has become a battle, and I'm going to win. And I usually do.
Her goal? To get insurers to cover her pregnant patient's addiction medicine. She slips on a headset. It disappears into her curly white blonde hair.
See, here's the mistake that they make, is they give me their, like, personal contact. Then I have it in my arsenal.
The medicine is called Subutex.
I know.
And without it, patients will go through withdrawal. possibly deliver early and lose the baby, relapse and expose the baby to infections, or overdose.
Hi, Silvana. My name's Catherine Grimes. I had spoken to you yesterday about a patient, Brianna Roerig.
With patients, she's Biz. With insurance providers, she's Catherine, her birth name.
Yeah, let me just pull up my...
The supervisor on the phone brings up Brianna's medical history.
Our doctors know what's going on, and are you a physician?
No, I'm not a physician. I just don't know.
Here's the problem. Even though Indiana Medicaid covers Subutex, insurance plans require paperwork before they'll approve it. The process is called prior authorization. Biz spends a lot of time refaxing information she's already sent, like patient's drug test results, proof they're in therapy. The hounding phone calls ensure these bureaucratic errors get fixed fast.
So I don't understand why any of that took place. I don't know why our pregnant patient was forced to withdraw for 3 days.
In this case, Biz got the approval, but Brianna's insurance plan still sent her a letter denying coverage, and amidst the confusion, Brianna stopped coming to the clinic and got sick from withdrawal.
If Biz wasn't around, I would have been screwed. I would have been without meds still, but she called and called and called and called until it finally went through.
Now 33-year-old Brianna is back on her medication and back at the clinic. She says before Biz, she fought her prior authorization battles alone. Sometimes approval took over a week, sometimes she'd sweat it out, other times she'd relapse.
This is what's so frustrating about it is their pregnancy, in theory, can be held hostage by these people who are not medical professionals.
There are many ways this can happen. It starts when the woman becomes pregnant. She will likely need to shift from her current medicine to Subutex. That requires a prior authorization. Then the state might switch her to a different insurance plan just for pregnant women. After delivery, she'll need to switch medications again. Also, she might require higher doses, especially in the third trimester. Each dose increase requires a prior authorization.
It's just insane. I mean, it's not like it's some, you know, unusual drug that just a very few, you know, number of people need. It's an epidemic.
Addiction treatment specialists say these roadblocks are a deliberate effort by the insurance industry to limit costs. Last year, New York outlawed prior authorizations for its Medicaid insurance plans, but in many states, patients still jump through hoops. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1464.
We hope you're enjoying 51% and Engines of Our Ingenuity, our featured podcast this month. We'd also love to hear your feedback at wlrh.org. So, as you've noticed, Monday's eclipse is a big deal. And as you might imagine, there's an app for that. Orange Wave Apps is based in Morgan County. It's created an app that's become an important tool for serious eclipse trackers. Shane Scott spoke with eclipse super enthusiast Dr. Gordon Telepin and Tony Boster, who created the app.
An eclipse is an amazing thing to experience, to be in the shadow of the moon when the moon's crossing in front of the sun. And I experienced my first one by going to Africa in 2001. And once you see one eclipse, you want to see more. So I went back to Africa in 2002 to see my second, and then did an eclipse in the Mediterranean Sea in 2006 for my third. So this wonderful eclipse that's going to be crossing our country will be my fourth total solar eclipse.
When you first observed such an eclipse in Africa in 2001, had you gone there specifically for that?
Yes. So when you're trying to pick an eclipse to go to, if you're going to travel a long distance, The things you consider are weather first. Are you going to have good weather in the place you're going to? And kind of the duration of the totality time. How long is the eclipse going to be? So I picked the 2001 eclipse specifically because it was in the middle of the dry season in Africa, in Zambia. So you had a very high percentage of not getting clouded out for the eclipse. That's a little bit of the problem for us in the United States for the 2017 eclipse because it's in the summer. And our summer weather tends to be or can be unstable. But everybody will just have to do the best they can to get to clear weather.
I suppose as I have looked forward to the eclipse like so many people, I've been concerned that it may turn out to be one of those things that's a bit anticlimactic. There's a lot of expectation ahead of it, and I wonder what the experience really will be like. You've obviously gone way out of your way to experience this multiple times. What's it like for you?
There's almost no way to explain it really to people. You have to witness it yourself. This is one of the times that the average person can actually see the motion of the celestial bodies. Because, you know, we go out at night and we see the full moon and it seems to be pretty steady and stagnant. It doesn't look like it's moving. The stars don't look like they're moving. But when you're at a total solar eclipse, you're physically seeing the moon in its motion around the Earth. And you're seeing the rotation of the Earth as you watch the whole event from C1 to C4, first contact to fourth contact. So you're seeing the rotation of the Earth, and you're seeing the movement of the moon. And it's just spectacular. Plus, the excitement of the crowd, the changes of the lighting, feeling the temperature going down because the sun's being blocked. If you're in a natural environment, hearing the crickets going crazy around you because they think nighttime is coming and it's in the middle of the day. There's just no way to experience it. And when I give my talks about this eclipse, and this is an eclipse that people can drive to in this country. They don't have to fly overseas to see it like I've had to do. I think they shouldn't miss it.
So, Tony, you came to be acquainted with this fellow and associated with him how?
He called me up one day. He's had the app. He wanted to have it redone in the latest modern versions of the smartphones. And so he found me through a friend, through an email, and just called me up and said, hey, I got this idea. And so we met up and
he brought you in on a project. I understand this was originally programmed for like Windows 98 and he wanted you to bring this into the iOS and Android age.
That's correct. Yep.
So can you just tell us a bit about the app?
It's really from where it started. We just wanted to recreate what was there first. And it's just a talking timer. So once you set up the contact times, it talks you through the entire process, everything to look for from the change in temperature to the lighting. And it's really a very, very good for photography, knowing when to start taking your pictures and that type of thing. And so we've incorporated all the smartphone features of GPS to locate your position, automatically calculate your contact times, show them to you, you know, provide the sequencing for the photography. It's grown quite a bit we've been on it since September, so it's been quite a process.
And it's been quite successful. You were telling me earlier you think of this as something that is good for just casual eclipse observers, families heading out to get a better view of the phenomenon, but also for people who want to engage it in a more professional manner, whether they be astronomers or photographers.
When my first version of the timer, the talking timer, was out, it was completely manual. So you had to know how to get your contact times, and you had to know how to program them in. But in the smartphone age, and having somebody like Tony, who's a smartphone programmer, we were able to harvest all the power of smartphones. The main one is GPS geolocation in mobile devices. So for the average family who are not astronomers, they're not scientists, but they want to enjoy this eclipse, they can be ready to enjoy the eclipse with just two taps on their smartphone. They have to know how to get into the path of totality, into the shadow of the moon. And then they tap on one icon, the phone finds their location. The formula for calculating the contact times is in the app, and that's what Tony made work. And then it spits out their contact times. So they load the contact times into the timer, and then my voice is recorded through the whole app, and I will talk them through the entire eclipse. So it's kind of like having your personal astronomer at the eclipse with you. So it's very simple for the average family to enjoy the eclipse and not miss anything. And then there's many levels that are much deeper for advanced photography, for the photographers and the astronomers who really want to get well-timed pictures of the eclipse, because there's certain parts of the eclipse that move very quickly in terms of capturing the images.
It's pretty amazing that all of this is coming out of Morgan County. You practice your medicine in Decatur, and you're down the road in Hartzell, a town with which I have great familiarity, family and friends there in Hartzell. Were you surprised to find the capability, the technical know-how that you needed essentially just down Highway 31?
I was surprised, and I was pleasantly surprised to meet Tony. We've had a great working relationship over really the past 9 months. No app is perfect when you release it, so we released the first version of iOS in February, and as we received user comments and feedbacks, we've made multiple little tweaks to make it better. No major adjustments. I think we had the app pretty well written from the first release, but we have made some changes through time. And it is amazing that we have such a talented mobile device programmer locally. This would have been a very hard project to do with programmers that are overseas, doing it through some overseas contract with a US-based company, but that subcontracts the programming to overseas, because it's a very technical app.
I understand you undertook a good deal of learning about astronomy from the doctor here in order to do the work that was necessary for this app. What has that process been like for you?
That's been good. I mean, you can hear it in Gordon's voice. I mean, he loves this stuff, and he wants to share and teach everybody. And so it's always great to work with somebody like that, because the enthusiasm for the project just helps. You know, it helps me want to make the changes. You know, he'll call me up or text me and say, hey, what about this? And, you know, I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do it. Let's try it. I think we can do it. And I've learned a little bit. I've got a lot to learn. There's a lot to it, a lot more than you'd ever know if you weren't, you know, around somebody like Gordon who knew, has been there and experienced, could tell you what you need to know. Photography, I have a clue what I was capable and what you really need to be looking for to make it, you know, a good experience. The other thing is you really got to get to the path. I mean, you know, probably most people didn't know that. I didn't know that. I thought you could stay here and really get the same experience, but you can't. You've got to get there, and the app helps you know if your location is in the path or not. It's been great. I mean, Gordon's just phenomenal with what he knows on this stuff.
And your software design firm, which is called Orange Wave, I believe?
Orange Wave Apps, yeah.
Does a lot of different work. A lot of folks, including my cousin Heath and his kid, probably have used your app for Dixie Youth Baseball. You do all sorts of things.
Yeah, Dixie Youth, that was our first one. We teamed up with them. I was a developer, and I didn't have an app for the longest. And it was kind of getting to me, right? Like, I got to have an app. Everybody's got an app. And so finally, we teamed up with Dixie Youth to do a statewide tournament. And that was a perfect example for an app, right? You needed the scores, notifications, and that was the Alabama State tournament, and then we moved and did the Dixie Youth World Series national tournament. And that's actually I'm going this weekend to do this year's as well. So that was a great learning experience and taught me a lot about apps. You know, same thing with this one. You know, you think a few people download it, but then thousands download it, and it's kind of cool and kind of fun when people are using your apps like that.
And I wanted to ask you about how you got into programming. It seems like it's a skill set that people with the necessary intelligence and the dedication can now pick up from anywhere if you put the resources in front of people and they dedicate the time and they have a talent for it. How did you get into it?
That's right. It was an interest I picked up. You know, I was not that great in school, bored, but then I first got to my first computer class and it just kind of clicked, and I could tell that was where my interest was. Once I got done playing basketball, I just knew computers was it, right? And then I ended up, you know, worked in Intergraph for about 10 years and learned a ton there. Big company like that, there's all kinds of opportunities to learn and go and do. And so, and then, you know, I kind of struck out on my own a little bit after that. Been doing bank type work and app type work. And so it's just an interest. It's my hobby as well as my job, right? Most programmers are. And nowadays, it's just fun what you can do. It's incredible what you can do with the technology, and especially things coming up with AR and VR and artificial intelligence. It's just amazing. So it's a fun time to be a programmer.
Very cool. Dr. Telepan, what would you say to folks who are just looking forward to this rare event pretty close to us? And do you have any advice for preparation?
No, I think they just need to first take the day off from work, and then they have to plan where they're going to go by, let's say, using one of the NASA Google interactive maps, where they can click on the map and look for a location that is close to drive to. This is a driving eclipse for everybody in the Tennessee Valley, because you just basically have to drive north to get into Tennessee. I would say at this point, avoid the big cities. Nashville is in the path of totality. It's going to be very, very busy. So I would either head on taking the small roads to east of Nashville or west of Nashville, staying off of the main roads on eclipse day, because there's going to be a lot of traffic. But I think everybody should realize it might be some effort. It might be a long day to drive to the path, enjoy the eclipse, and drive back. But it could be a once-in-a-lifetime experience for many people, because the next two are in 2019 and in 2020, and they cross Chile in South America. So people are not going to fly down there to go to an eclipse. So for an eclipse that's crossing the entire country and an eclipse that's this close to the Tennessee Valley, I think folks need to get to it.
And you, sir, are you planning to do anything special on Eclipse Day, the 21st of August? Are you going to travel? Or?
Oh, yeah, we're going with Gordon. Wherever we have to go to find it, you know, we got to make sure this thing, I got to see it in action, in the path. So we'll get the families together and we'll find us a clear spot and have a good time.
There are all sorts of eclipse viewing events happening across the Tennessee Valley at UAH, at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, at the Huntsville Botanical Garden, even at the Huntsville-Madison County Convention and Visitors Bureau. You can find a podcast of tonight's show and links to topics we covered this hour at WLRH.org/Public Radio Hour. The Public Radio Hour is built weekly by WLRH staff and volunteers. Thanks for listening. City Arts and Lectures is next.